Samara, do you remember the first time I hosted a less than stellar whiskey club meeting at my house and you happened upon my band of hooligans hosting whiskey for the first time? One of the first times?
I don't think they were hooligans.
we were trying to do a Black History Month whiskey tasting. That's what happened. And it was great. The thing is about whiskey is that it brings everybody together. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people don't really care about the execution. It's the fact that you executed it. And look, I was like, oh, I'm a writer. I'm a creative. I'm going to tell this story of, hey, look, you need to know about Uncle Nearest. That was like the easy part. Mm-hmm. And I was like, look, here's this tie to Jack Daniels. We're going to sip some Gentleman Jack today. And that's fine. And now I'm running out of Black people. here's this celebrity whiskey with Drake, with Virginia God. Black. And honestly, when I saw your face, when you saw that was on the table, I was like, oh, she's about to turn around and leave. She's about to leave. And you smiled through it and you were really nice. And I'm always curious, like, I wonder what her thoughts were after leaving our house. Cause you came to my house. That was just like the first time I ever got a chance to really interact with you. And I just always wonder how you felt about that.
I didn't feel one way or another. I actually had a really good time. I always enjoy sitting down, meeting new people and sharing a dram or two, doing education and just talking to folks. So, you know, I didn't leave with any judgment. You know? You know, like, yes, I totally did judge you for the Drake. But, you know, I think it's really interesting that you said, like, you run out of Black people really quickly in the whiskey industry. There's not that many brands. There are a few brands that have come out since then.
Yes.
You know, that we could have added to that portfolio or to that flight tasting that we did. But I had fun. And, you know, everyone was being their authentic selves. Everybody was cool, you know, so I was cool.
Let me not go any further before I tell people we are talking to Samara Rivers, founder, creator of Black Bourbon Society. You've seen this woman stunting in the New York Times. I see her stunting in Forbes. I mean, so I'm like, dang, like she was just chilling in the crib with me and the homies drinking Blantons. And now like she's over here in the Times, like doing her thing. Like I just, you know, big ups. Like that was just amazing. Like how'd that feel? Like you just opened it up, like boom, right there.
It felt good. It felt good to be heard, you know, right. And like I created Black Bourbon Society with this mission of really wanting to see more diversity within the industry.
Right.
And having recognition in the New York Times and in Forbes and in other publications, for me, it just meant validation.
Right.
And it meant that we were on the right track. My mission, the passion behind Black Bourbon Society was being taken seriously. And it was respected. Mm-hmm. So I was, it took a while for it to sink in for me. Like mm-hmm. when I did the interview and I was like, okay, when is it going to print? When is this going to happen? I just couldn't believe it. And actually I didn't have time to process it correctly. The day I found out that I was going to be in the Times and just, they were setting up the interview, was the day one of my really, really close members and most avid members of Black Bourbon Society passed away. And so it was a day of like excitement, but it was also overshadowed just because I was in absolute awe that I had lost a really good friend of mine on the same day. And it's kind of like when it finally did came out, like that day was just kind of like, oh, yay. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't like my life changed.
right. It's always interesting when you know you've got something you've got to embargo and you can't quite, it's not here yet. You've got to, and because your life still has to go on. It doesn't matter that you've got all this excitement brewing in your head, back of your head. You're like, yay, I'm ready to celebrate, do my thing. And then it finally happens and you're like, oh, that feels like so long ago. It doesn't even process in the same way.
Well, I think the thing is that, you know, the goal of Black Bourbon Society wasn't accomplished in that moment. Like sure. I said, it was just a validation point. And yes, so like, I won't really feel that big sigh of relief, that big overjoyment until like the work is actually done. But we still have a lot. I mean, just this, you know, past couple of weeks, you know, you've seen us write this open letter to the industry saying yeah. like, where are you? Are you mm-hmm. with us or not? Like, we have made a dent in this industry, but a very small dent in the grand scheme of things. So, yeah, I enjoyed having that publication, but I still got work to do. We're still nowhere near to the goals we have to accomplish for this.
And I want to get to the goals here in a minute, but I want to take a slight step back because remind me, Black Bourbon Society, you founded it when?
May 31st, 2016.
Okay.
So a little over 4 years ago.
And when May 31st, 2016 happened and the lead up before you officially started it, founded it, did people get it? Like when you started sharing like that idea with people, what were the initial reactions to what you were trying to do?
So I started it very small and I was living in the Bay Area up in Oakland at the time.
One time to the town.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. and so it was local and the initiative was working with the local brand ambassadors there in the city. And they picked it up. They challenged me, you know, because I brought it to their attention. You know, why aren't we creating amazing direct consumer marketing events like the one I was planning for this one brand? How come we're not creating that for African Americans? And the brand rep I was working with just honestly told me, well, we didn't know you drank whiskey, or we didn't know that this was something for your target audience. Like, this isn't on our benchmarks for our marketing strategies.
Right.
And so it was really like, oh, let me show you. Yeah. And so it was planning events in Oakland and having sold out events constantly and that the brands realized like, oh, this is big, you know? And then very quickly we did that in Oakland. We moved over to Atlanta and produced an event here and same thing. And so people were just interested. People just wanted to be a part of it. And, you know, it just kind of grew from there. It grew organically from there. But then it exploded when, of course, we went on social media, when we created the private Facebook group. Mm-hmm. That's when our numbers just took off and we started collecting members in all sorts of cities and all sorts of countries, you know, across the globe.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. and what's been, you know, you talk now, you start going about that mission. And when was the first time that, and maybe it was an event or maybe it was a collaboration, but what was the first time that the light bulb not only went off for you, but the brands and the decision makers, that they were like, oh, we've got found money here? Because look, there's nothing like digging in the laundry and you dig in the pocket and you find a 20. Like, you weren't expecting it. It doesn't matter if it was yours or you found it for someone else. But like that moment when you're like, oh, there's this space and nobody's here. Or mm-hmm. and the one of the first questions is like, well, why ain't you here? But that's your solve. You're solving that for them. But like, right. What was that light bulb moment that you can distinctly remember?
The very first event that we did in Oakland, we did it at this club called Era.
I got in a lot of trouble at Era, but keep going.
So we did it on the top floor at Era. Yeah. Uh-huh. We partnered with Brown-Forman. So mm-hmm. Old Forester was our main sponsor. We got a chance to have, you know, Old Forester cocktails, and we also did a special tasting of Old Forester birthday bourbon.
Nice.
For 2016 birthday bourbon. And I noticed immediately when you stepped back and started seeing all these social groups and, you know, connecting, and, you know, some were my personal friends, some were from my Jack and Jill chapter, some were mm-hmm. colleagues that I worked with. Like, everyone was kind of like in my network, but they all came out to support what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And when I took a step back and I saw all my different pockets of friends that mm-hmm. are friends with me, but not friends with each other, starting to collaborate and exchange cards right. and connect, that's when I realized, like, oh shit, sorry, I don't know if I can cuss on your show.
Let it fly, you're good.
Okay, but I really was like, oh shit, like, think about everyone's net worth in the room, not only financially, fiscally, but intellectually.
Right.
And that's when I was just like, oh, this is bigger than bourbon. This is really, this is an opportunity for Black excellence to connect with one another on a level, especially, and you know this through your work, when you put a cocktail or a dram of whiskey in their hands, everybody's ego goes out the door. So it doesn't matter if you're a CEO or if you work for Twitter or you work for Facebook, like, mm-hmm. nobody cares. Mm-hmm. It's just, are you having fun? How can we collaborate? And so that's one thing that I noticed that I never expected until mm-hmm. the moment I actually stood back in the room and just saw it.
Yeah. And that's magical. It's funny. I can speak very, I don't want to say selfishly, but I just think about when I first went down my path, and I remember you and I had the conversation about, like, when I was starting my whiskey club, I started our terrible name at the time was the Golden Society of Whiskey Tasters. Cause again, it's like, it's terrible. This is what we did. I started it in my basement with four of my frat brothers, and the whole goal was just like, yo, let's just put some money together and buy some different whiskeys that we've never tried before. And, like, let's just have fun. And we got wasted, and we went and got some food on Telegraph, some tacos on Telegraph after the fact. And I looked back at the notes we had, and it was great. And, but what I started to realize when I would go in public, and, you know, at the time in the Bay, like, I've worked in tech, and I work in sports and sports media now. And I'm in social groups like the 100 and Alpha and things like that. And so, just if somebody doesn't know you, and it just naturally comes up, like, oh, like, what are you into? Like, oh, I have a whiskey club. They're like, huh? What? tell me more. And it was amazing the people that either I wanted to, you know, I was really intrigued to have a relationship with, or the conversations that would come after the fact, just because of that shared interest. And frankly, like, we might not have had any other real interests that weren't basic. Like, we can always talk about sports and the weather and the season finale of Insecure, and, you know, because that was crazy last night. But anyway, you know,
you can ask that question.
Man, listen, that was I did not expect the baby to be coming. But anyway, spoiler alert.
I did.
You did? Okay, we're going to save it.
Blowing up her phone, his phone, like, two episodes ago.
That is true. Ooh, so we should have known the spoiler ahead of time. Ooh, okay. All right, we're going to put a pin on that.
I be knowing.
Be knowing. Samara be knowing. Okay. Anyway, to put a button on that, I just was really intrigued to see that something as special as bourbon and whiskey and scotch and can really peel back a different envelope to, like, more conversation, and to be hokey about it, bring us together. Like, oh, yeah. I can have this conversation with you, and that opens up so many other doors. And so I think for you, like, you've been on the forefront of that industry, because you've been in the industry for how long now?
Since 2016.
So, but what you were doing before, so tell people, before you started Black Bourbon Society, though, what was your focus career-wise?
So I have an art history degree.
Okay.
And so I was working as a curator at a museum in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And then I left that to go into consulting for nonprofit fundraising and mm-hmm. events. So I've always had a side hustle of planning events. Like, gotcha. I've done that since I was in college. So I've worked in the nonprofit space. I've worked as a nonprofit, as a development, like fundraising money. Sure. But then also really putting on, like, galas, fundraisers, cocktail hours, like, all of that. So it's really interesting. I talked about this with my partner the other day, how every decision you make rolls into another decision, into another, and gets you to where you are today. And so your decisions have so much weight. They don't feel like every small decision leads to the bigger picture. And so I was I gotten laid off. I was development director for Leukemia Lymphoma Society team and training program. I just wrote about this because it has a lot to do with what's going on now, right? I was the only in all of the Bay Area who worked for the Leukemia Lymphoma Society. The only woman who went work for them. And the only Black woman. And so I left that after I got pushed out of that position because I didn't fit in with the sorority girls and the culture and the thing. This came up after the article with Refinery 29. Have you seen that?
Yes, I did. Yes.
So this is what where my story came up, and I started recollecting and remembering everything. So I then started consulting, and I started my own nonprofit consulting firm and doing events.
Sure.
I was doing an event for a woman who had her own podcast and book launch and wanted to do these Sunday brunches. So I planned her event for her, and it was at one of those events I met a woman in the spirits industry who had just moved to the Bay.
Got it.
And so she asked me to come on and work underneath her to help her execute all these events for the brands while she got settled and got familiar with the Bay Area. And from there, I asked her, I said, how come we're not planning these events? Now we go back to what we just said earlier.
Sure.
And she showed me her marketing deck. I didn't see anybody who looked like me. And I said, bet, this is where BBS comes in. So that's my trajectory. My trajectory just comes out of being in the right place at the right time, just falling into the, literally falling into the path.
Right.
And just rolling with it.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing is like, once you start to see like, oh, you start to see the success, you start to see where you can fit in and make a difference. Like that's actually when it, I don't want to say it's easier, but it's like, because we're not in the space, like there's nobody there to tell you no. Right. And right. There's nowhere to be like, oh, there's like staunch competition. Like, you know, like I said, I'm a sports editor for the NBA. And if I said I wanted to create a website covering the NBA, there's like 7,000 of those. Right. And he in the space here. But the difference is like there's a huge market of people that do want to be served NBA content. When I start thinking about whiskey and you start thinking about consumers, not only consumers of color, I think the thing that we've tried to do with Brown Liquor Collective is I think we really want to focus on, you know, people of color, sippers of color, but then also be, you know, how can we make it inclusive? How can we make people feel comfortable? And then how can we keep like a younger generation of people coming in that feel like, hey, this is a spirit that's good for you, right? Because I think about when we're young, you know, I mean, I was just talking about this on the podcast with Tinsley, and I don't want to spoil one of my questions that on the survey I'm going to ask you at the end, but I used to drink Malibu coconut rum and Sprite at 22, and I'd go to the bar confidently, like, yes, I'm going to have Malibu rum and Sprite. My dear, what would you like? Would you like something? Yeah. And like, that was me being terrible at 22. Like I didn't know I was terrible. I mean, and maybe I wasn't terrible for the time, but this is what that's I thought terrible. I was supposed to. It was absolutely terrible. But I, you know, hey, I'm a product of my environment. I'm going to spoil some of these questions. So I'm going to pivot ahead. Cause I want to get your thoughts on some of those things, but right. Thinking about now, and so, you know, between you and like you and our good friend Dominique and Fawn and like just these powerful, there are like a lot of powerful Black women in the space doing awesome things with whiskey. And so how have things changed now to like your expectations might have been here and they were already probably high. I got to imagine now as we're going into 2020 and beyond that you have a whole new set of ideas and expectations on where you think the business is and where we fit into it. But like, what do those things look like for you as we go forward?
So, you know, we've been at this for 4 years and really working with the brands and how they approach their consumers. Mm-hmm. And do direct consumer marketing events, taking trips. We take our members to Louisville for these one-on-one experiences. Yes. So we sat as this bridge between the brands and the Black consumers or consumers of color, and just kind of showed each other, like, this is what this is about. These are who we are, you know? And so everybody has this love and connection now. And that's been very successful. But I think the real work is now to look more towards the brands.
Yes.
And to help them with their D&I issues. Because the reason why we exist is because they don't have anyone internally that advocates for marketing and to consumers of color. And if they are, I mean, they really don't know what they're doing. They're following stereotypes. They're following trends that may not be necessarily true.
Yeah.
And it comes off very ingenuine. And so, you know, for me, with especially with our announcement and our creation of our nonprofit, Diversity Distilled, it is to look more internally with in the brands. It's not just enough that you have African-American employees in your company. The African-American employees in your company need to be in key leadership positions. They need to be in positions where they make decisions, not being told what to do and not just, you know, stuck in the department called multicultural, you know, like they need to actually be in HR. They need to be in the C-suite. They need to be in those marketing meetings.
Sure.
So now we're really, you know, pivoting and looking directly at the brands, assessing their organizations, and helping them to recruit, retain, and promote Black talent and, you know, diverse talent, I'll say that, within their company.
Mm. And with that, I also, so now that brings up, you know, Uncle Nearest, right? Mm-hmm. And not only Uncle Nearest, but one of the things that they announced is that they're really investing, they're collaborating with Jack Daniels, and they're really investing in education and the process of how do we help, you know, Black folks start their own distillery and like come up with their own product. And that is such a generational ask, right?
Yep.
Because there's one thing we know about whiskey, if it hits a barrel, it takes time. Like it takes real time. It takes real education. And, you know, do you think that we are going to see a new era of Black distillers? And if so, what does their success ultimately depend on? Because I think as a storyteller, I think about what Uncle Nearest has done, and the thing that they've got two great things going for them. Well, they have, number one, they have an excellent spirit, which that does a lot of the heavy lifting right there. But mm-hmm. the second thing is they have an excellent story.
Right.
And that is a story that comes almost out of a movie, right? And
right.
and they've done such an excellent job in telling it, and it makes it so easy to buy into. And, you know, I like to think that, you know, we will always prop up our own if we feel like it's worth it. And that product can stand on its own without, but the fact that we are going to support it and push it, it just makes it the success story that much more infinitely greater. But I am curious about newer brands that have to try to break through. Like that ask is going to be heavy. I wonder what are the things you think are going to matter for them to get on the shelf, to get in somebody's bar, and ultimately have some staying power in the business.
Well, I want to go back to Uncle Nearest. Uncle Nearest does have great juice, but we have to remember that they source. So mm-hmm. Uncle Nearest is building a distillery. They will one day distill, but just like, you know, the rest of the Black brands that are starting to bubble up, everybody is sourcing whiskey for right now.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with sourcing whiskey. Tons of brands source and have no plans on ever distilling.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing wrong with that. But like you said, it's really picking the right barrels. It's really picking the right blend. And just rocking with the story and the marketing efforts behind it that makes a brand a brand.
Yes.
So as I think of, you know, even I think, you know, Uncle Nearest is doing it well. They are the largest. They are global. They have great marketing. And they have a major workforce behind them to get that name and that story out on a consistent basis. So it seems like they've got it all together, but all the Black brands are pretty much in the same bucket. They've all got to invest for generational growth.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it costs money. The main thing is it costs money. Michael Beach, who is a whiskey historian and writer,
mm-hmm.
he did an article about the cost of creating a whiskey brand and actually distilling, and it costs about a good $20 million just to get started. You're absolutely right. Once you finally do build your distillery, start distilling your juice, if it's going to be any good, it's going to take at least 4 to 6 years before you can actually pull it and start to sell that juice. So in the meantime, you do source, you do fill in with a great partnership with another source of whiskey to just continue to work on that brand loyalty aspect of it. And I think that's really where the brands can last and the brand loyalty has to be in it. But for distillers who really want to make a difference, African-American distillers need to know that this is a job that you love. It's all about a brand that you love, but you're not going to get rich making this. And unfortunately, and Fawn has candidly mentioned this, a lot of us aren't in it to not make money. Because we got to survive, you know?
It's work, yeah, it's real.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, but it is a sacrifice. In order for us to get this thing going generationally, you either have to have a lot of money behind you, and you've got to have a ton of passion to just be consistent and to roll with the punches.
When you think about whiskey clubs and social groups now, are there things you wish or you would encourage us to take like the next step on as far as the conversations we're having or the things that we're trying, or the people that we are including? I think one of the first things you challenged me on is like, you know, well, what does your group look like? Well, where are the women at and things like that? And it's like, what? And I remember I was like, I think I was just starting to, I was very candid at first. I was like, no, this is supposed to be for the fellas. Like, no, like we good.
You're not inclusive.
Right. Well, yeah, like that is just the truth of it. Like we had to grow and so that goes back to the conversation I was having about just telling people you have a whiskey club. And what turned the light bulb for me to a degree was just like how many women that were like, yo, I want to come and I want to come through. I have things to contribute. And it was never to be exclusive because I didn't care about their thoughts. Truthfully, I was still learning myself on what I wanted from this. Right. And I don't know, a lot of times I think that has something to do with it is just like feeling comfortable letting your hair down. I mean, that's why I have a hat. I don't have any hair anymore, but letting your hair down, like being exposed, being willing to learn, being willing to be wrong. And, you know, as OJ Lima, the first guest on the podcast said, like, there's nothing we've ever done where women weren't included and it wasn't cooler. Like that just not true. So, anyway, OJ was great. OJ was great. Uh-huh. And, but I bring that question back to you. Like, what are the things that, you know, people, there are a lot of people that want to start whiskey clubs or are in social groups and, you know, how do they take their experience from good to great? Like, what are the things that you always encourage?
What goes from good to great is you're not only talking about whiskey, but you're constantly learning about it. Mm-hmm. And so the education piece is huge. And that's something that we've really focused on in BBS. It's teachable tidbits. We do those every Tuesday within the group. And it's just me doing a Facebook Live just saying like, okay, we're going to talk about what makes a whiskey or what makes Canadian whiskey. Like I did a one on Canadian whiskey the other day.
You know, you love Crown Royal.
I started off with Canadian whiskey. Okay. But let me tell you why. But anyways, I think the more education you can give someone, the more they actually, they feel empowered and they fall in love deeper with the spirit. They actually appreciate it more because they know that, oh, we're just not drinking this because it's smooth. Yeah. We're drinking it because it's aged a certain way. It's distillate has this amount of corn or wheat or whatever in it. We know that where the water source comes from. So we become big geeks in BBS just because knowledge is power in all sorts of ways. And also, again, it shapes your buying habits. You know, now you're looking to see, okay, well, where are you sourcing from? Are you sustainable? What's your mission? What's your diversity, D&I makeup in your companies? You know, are you racist? You know? which we have to call up brands out for being like blatantly racist, right. You know? So the more education you can give makes a better experience.
Yeah, for sure. And I appreciated one thing the thing that I appreciate about growing older, well, is somehow having gray in a beard actually is working out for me. So that's one good thing about getting older. The second thing of getting older is that I have no problem being wrong or like taking advice. Like, it's okay. Like, being wrong and failing is actually has been pretty awesome in my life. It's like helped save me time. It's helped make me better. And, I think even when you called me out on it, I was like, well, I wasn't ready, but like, I'm ready to get ready. And so let's do it. And, I look at our Facebook group and it's like, it's good. Like, 44% of our members are women. And like, that's to me, that's pretty good. Like, I mean, I don't know what the industry standard is of whiskey consumers in America, but I don't think it's 44%. I would just guess. So like, our numbers
are very similar to yours. Mm-hmm. Ours are like, it's like 46%. And for a while, it was like 50-50. It was dead on 50-50. Mm-hmm. But yes, women want to be where you guys are. We want to be sitting at the bar. We don't want to just be, women have their own stereotypes.
Yes.
So it's like, we don't want to be out to dinner with our bosses and our colleagues and everyone's ordering scotch or whiskey. And then we order a Cosmo.
Yeah,
sure. I want to be able to know what whiskeys you're drinking, and I want to be able to order one too, or I want to order a better one on my boss's dime,
Man, yes.
So
let me put the boss on to something. Yes.
Yeah, and put the boss on, because that's how and what we've learned that and you're a little bit younger than me, but as you progress in your career, people go from Crown in your 20s to bourbon in your early 30s to scotch. And the higher your career point is, the more rare and more fine your collection gets.
Sure, right? Sure.
So we want to know all those things because we don't like being basic. Black people hate being basic.
Man, preach.
Preach. We want to know it all. We want to be the expert.
you have not spoken a lie, and black folks love putting other black folks onto something, and
on that new
amen. Yes. So speaking of putting folks onto something, I'm gonna put you on to the Sip Mightily questionnaire. This is the last thing we do in every interview. It's inspired by Dave Chappelle when he was on Inside the Actor Studio with James Lipton. It's an interview that you can find on YouTube. And James Lipton basically stole this and modified this interview from writers in France, Pivot and Prost. And so I stole this from him, and I have modified it for my own to make it work for our audience. So if you are ready, it's 10 questions. Let's do it. The first one is always the softball. It's the easiest thing to answer. What is your favorite thing to sip, Samara Rivers?
Favorite thing to sip? It depends on the day, honestly. Okay. Some of my favorite pours are Elijah Craig Barrel Proof, mm-hmm. Shanks, which is made by Michter's. You can only get it in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Those are probably two of my absolute favorites that I can think of.
You say the Elijah Craig. Are you talking about the 12-year,
the barrel proof?
Oh, okay, the barrel proof. Okay, my apologies. You and OJ have similar taste.
It's 133 proof.
Yes. And
it always just...
Yes.
Right on home.
So earlier, you shamed me when I told you that I used to drink Malibu rum and Sprite, but... Before Samara was a bit more sophisticated with her consumption, was there something you used to drink that you would never drink now?
Huh. Okay. When I was in high school, that's when I first started drinking. We'd get off early on Friday afternoons. We'd come back to my house. My parents wouldn't be there. We'd watch The Box showing you how much older I am than you. But we do that, and I would make a screwdriver with 151 Bacardi and orange. That was my every Friday cocktail from 16 and 17, my junior and senior year in high school.
And what would it take for you to drink one of those now? duly noted. Samara, when was the last time you cheers, when you the last time you had a chance to clink drinks and celebrate, and what was it for?
We clink drinks every Friday for our BYOB happy hour that mm-hmm. we do with Black Bourbon Society. It's our virtual happy hour that we started when COVID hit, and it's been a great connector to keep all of our members engaged, for mm-hmm. me to lay eyeballs on my members to make sure everybody is like healthy and still in their right mind,
sure.
And not suffering. And so we always virtually clink drinks for that every Friday.
Number four, is there a spirit or distillery that you've wanted to visit or you've wanted to try and you've yet to be able to do so?
Whistle Pig.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't made it up to Vermont yet.
Will you also go get some Ben and Jerry's while you're up there?
No.
No?
I can't.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, you know, I mean, it's basically maple syrup, Whistle Pig, and Ben and Jerry's. It's only three reasons to go up there. Or the teddy bear.
I want to go like on some nice trails and like enjoy the leaves falling and changing colors.
I've heard that's like the most beautiful thing in Vermont. I've been told this. I have not been convinced to go up there. Just somebody said you should go there to see the foliage turn. I was like, that's not enough. But like, if you get me to go to Whistle Pig, like maybe I could be convinced. But I digress. Okay.
But no, turning 40, I can't eat many things these days. I can't eat like I did.
Okay, fair enough. More for me. How about that? Yeah. Number five. What memories do you have of your parents or the OGs in your life when they were sipping and when they were partying and kicking back? So I preface this by saying, I tell the story of my grandmother. My grandmother used to drink Johnny Walker Red with milk and an olive. Okay. And it's funny because I never knew that. And one of the first things I started to really like when I was mixing cocktails was using Johnny Walker Red. And I told my mother this, and my mother then proceeded to tell me she used to drink scotch with milk and olive or whatever. And that when I was younger, she would have parties with her social club, the Sherlights, and they would play Pinochle and Bidwiz.
Nice.
And I would be a baby, 3-4 years old, and I'd get into my grandmother's arm and I would ruin the game because I'd be like King of Spades and 10 of Clubs and Ace of Diamonds. And my grandmother would so eloquently say, yeah, put this baby to bed before I throw him. And, you know, my mother is a mother usher in the church. Like, I'm like, you know, I didn't know she used to talk about me this way. She, you know, so I always think it's really interesting to hear, what did we experience when we were younger with the people that we looked up to, and like, how did they kick it and how did they consume, and like, what did those memories look like to us?
My parents never really drank like that, which is why they had all that Bacardi 151 underneath their cabinet.
Yes.
Because I think before I was born, like in the 70s, they went on cruises and got a whole bunch of liquor from like duty free or something. And it kept in there collecting dust. Until I turned 16, and they never realized I drank all their stuff because they never went in there. But my dad did used to drink Asti Spumante, champagne. Well, he used to drink that every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
My mother drank wine a lot. And, you know, before I became a whiskey drinker, I drank a ton of wine too. So.
Okay.
Especially how I formed my palate was basically off of, you know, falling in love with wine.
Samara, question six. Do you have a favorite pair of sneakers?
I have some Nikes.
Okay. Do you have one that's like your favorite, like a go-to?
No, I don't wear sneakers like that. I do have a pair of like crisp Air Force Ones though. Like they don't have the lace on them. They just have the Velcro.
Okay. That works. That's okay.
So I wanted like some like high top sneakers to wear, so I got those.
So one of the things that I can talk about some of this, but there was a chance in 2021 we were going to do a sneaker collaboration with a Scotch brand. Because there's an interesting like Venn diagram of like sneakerheads and like whiskey drinkers. Let's just say if I could get a free pair of sneakers and some free alcohol out of it, that's like the dream scenario. So who knows? I might need to be working with you on figuring out how to make this happen in 2021. We need to make this happen. Number seven, Samara, I have now made you a professional fighter. You are about to go into the ring. Okay. What music do you walk out to?
I don't know.
Like, what's the music that's gonna get you battle ready? Like, I'm about to go in here and tear somebody's head off.
Oh, I know. That song by Beyonce. It's on DJ Khaled's album.
Oh, not Shining. Top, oh, Top of Maybach. Okay, yes. I feel like you and the wife would both choose that song for sure. That is excellent. Okay.
And it would be the Coachella live performance of that.
If I ever want to put the wife in a good mood, sometimes I'll just play it before she walks in the door, and then she doesn't even make it anywhere else in the house. She just sits down and she's just happy. And then I'll bring her a French 75 and she just sits there for like 2 hours. And it's just like, and it's good, because then I get peace and she gets peace. And it's like, this is like an epic opportunity. So the Beyonce Coachella performance is a must watch television once or twice a month in our household.
Yes.
Yes, for sure.
My kids actually will stop and watch it too. They are in absolute awe of Beyonce.
Yeah, that's cool. That's very cool. That's awesome. A few more questions, and then we'll be done here. Number eight. So seeing how you told me about 151 in your life, what is like the craziest true story from a night of just being out the town? So to be fair, I'm going to go first, and I'm going to tell the story I told in the last pod, because I was in New Orleans, and I feel like all really good stories happen in New Orleans.
Mine was actually in New Orleans too.
And I was at the House of Blues, and I was there for a conference with a journalist conference, and then another group of my really good friends just said, "Hey, by the way, we're in New Orleans just to kick it." And I was like, "Yo, we should all just be in New Orleans." And so there were some really popular ESPN personalities there, and some of my really good friends that I had met on Twitter of all places, and we just got really close. And it's like 10 of us, and we're at House of Blues, and the company was paying for drinks, so this was already like, this was like a, now the fuel was rampant. And I don't know how I got home, but I was told that I was ushered away happily on a horse and carriage that took me back to my hotel. And that was how I got home that night, allegedly, because I don't remember. But anyway, I pass it to you, Samara. Do you have what is that night? What does a particular night stand out for you? What does it look like?
So just so it's clear, I don't have many drunken nights that I can't remember at this age anymore.
Sure.
Like, because it hurts like for a whole week after the fact.
Amen. Yes.
But I will say in New Orleans, I was there for Tales of the Cocktail. And if you ever get a chance, Eddie, I think you should really go.
I'm making plans.
To Tales of the Cocktail. It's a 7-day bartending conference. All of the brands are there. There are educational opportunities, like, you know, there's seminars and there's cocktail demos and, you know, people talking about emulsification and all this bartending science. Like, so there actually is knowledge being shared on top of back-to-back-to-back-to-back brand activations.
Sure.
So you've got the Tito's breakfast. You know, coffee by Tito's. You've got the big absolute pool party that happens every year on the rooftop of Hotel Monteleone. Mm-hmm. You've got all these different activations that you literally just walk into one, drink all their drinks for free. Everything's free, by the way, because it's a part of Tales. And then you stumble out and then you go to another activation. So you've got to like, so
it's an endurance race. Yes.
It's So you have to learn how to pace yourself at that conference. But the first go around, nobody ever does. Mm-hmm. And the last, the most memorable one that I had was something that Diageo put together, and it was a Snoop Dogg concert.
Ooh.
And it was, I mean, it was weed everywhere. It was I don't think there was any food in that building whatsoever, but just like all of their brands, anything that Diageo created, all of their brands were just there passing out cups and just all sorts of cocktails. So you went from IW Harper, just whatever, Crown, whatever, every brand you can imagine that falls underneath the Diageo label was there. And you just saw Snoop perform and sang out loud, sing off key, rapped with him. It was the most amazing experience ever.
Yeah, it sounds like I've just booked my ticket to go to Tales of the Cocktail whenever Corona is a wrap.
Yeah, it's virtual this year, which is not going to be fun at all, just because of the brand. Oh, the Bacardi activation was like neon Miami lights outside. Grey Goose had the amazing thing where they were just like, they poured like wine glasses full of like Grey Goose cocktails. But then when you went inside, it was like this whole tropical jungle. And had DJs, they had dancers, they had, Bacardi on the like frozen icy machine. So they had like banana frozen treats. They've had cocktails. Then they had a whole taco truck. It was a whole experience. Like they have to spend at least 600, you know, or six figures.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Those activations for Tales.
I think anytime I go to any massive conference like that, I think about going to like E3, for example, and you were just like, this is $1 million activation.
Mm-hmm.
When I've done stuff with Nike before, and like, you know, Nike's like, yeah, we're just going to take over Times Square. And it's like, oh, y'all, this is different. And like you, and I honestly, like the stuff that I did with, you know, Nike, like really actually helped me decide to like change my career path. And I think you start to realize, to your point, that these companies, it's not like they're not resource light.
No.
So they're not resource light. And when you're not resource light and yet you're not willing to pour in the resources properly for us and for things that matter to us, as simple as making a statement, maybe having one of us on the board or you know, making sure your messaging is a little tighter. Like these things, like, I can't remember the lady who was speaking when, you know, we've been talking about like Black Lives Matter and things like that. But like, I always kind of feel like what we're asking for is not actually a lot. But it requires, a bit of empathy. It requires a bit of taking your ego down and being willing to not only listen, but recalibrate, like, what are your core values and are you really aligned with what your core values are? And so, you know, you go to an event like that and you're like, oh, there's like literally tens of millions of dollars being spent on just making the influencers in the room influence. So anyway, that's a bit of a tangent. We're going to figure this out. We need to host a panel. We need to make, now I'm inspired a little bit more for sure.
So I've been wanting to do some sort of roundtable discussion, especially after we wrote our open letter and our corporate company statement. I think it is important for us to have several roundtable discussions like this moving forward. And so sign me up. Maybe it's something we can do in collaboration.
Uh-huh.
I just, I, I, I've gotten inundated with a lot of stuff since we wrote that letter, and I've got some deadlines that I need to push out. So I haven't had the brain capacity to focus on it, but I absolutely think it's needed. And I think the more we can stay connected and continue to preach that message, we also hold the brands accountable.
Yeah.
Like, it's great. They finally made a statement, but we need way more than a statement. We need investment, you know?
Yeah.
And it just can't be lip service. I don't think we will tolerate that anymore.
No, I'm with you 100%. I want to make sure we finish here.
Okay, a lot of questions. I got one more.
We got two more and then we're done. Okay. All right. Samara, I just gave you a golden ticket to play in a game show. However, there is a caveat to this ticket. You must win, or you must drink all of those terrible cocktails you used to drink when you were 16. What game show do you play, and how likely do you think you are to actually win?
Wheel of Fortune.
Okay. All right. You're going to spin the wheel. You think you can beat the wheel?
Solve the puzzle. Yeah.
I actually think that, like, so it's funny, like, I think OJ came on and picked Jeopardy, and I was immediately like, oh, your confidence levels are insanely high. And Tinsley came on, Justin Tinsley was our last guest, and he came and picked Cash Cab. And I'm like, okay, like, that was such an odd choice, off only because, like, I don't even know how you win or lose. I think you just either win money or you don't. So, like, I don't know if you can actually win the game or not. I think I probably gave him a pass. But Wheel of Fortune to me is, like, the median point of, like, okay, like, there is skill involved.
Yeah.
But, like, the playing field is level, so much so. And you just need a little bit of luck. And, you know, if you hit the right dollar amount, like, it doesn't even matter if I don't win all the puzzles. I just need to win the right puzzle with the right money.
Right.
You know? Right. So
either that or Family Feud. Like, I think anybody could win. Like, we should do a whiskey team of Family Feud. Like, we could kill that.
Sounds like a future fundraiser. Boom. See? Collaboration. Collaboration in the making. Last question. You know what? We'll stick to TV shows here. You get to have drinks with Oprah.
With Lisa and Molly.
Wait, who'd you just say?
With Lisa and Molly.
Okay, all right. Cool, I love it already. You get to have drinks with Issa and Molly. Issa Rae, Yvonne Orji. The character or the real actors? Which one would you prefer?
Either one, actually.
Okay.
It changes because the hot mess characters are a different conversation than what I'd have with Yvonne and Issa in real life.
So let's just assume we're having a wind down segment after the HBO show, but you get to curate what they drink, what you all would be drinking.
Ooh,
and nice. You get to curate the conversation. So what do you sip with the two of them, and how does the conversation go?
We are having whiskey cocktails. We'll probably have paper planes, which is my favorite.
Okay, tell people what paper planes are.
So a paper plane is one part Aperol, Amaro, lemon juice, and bourbon.
Got it.
So you can't mess it up. Simply,
can't mess it up.
Yeah, Aperol, Amaro, lemon juice, bourbon, one part of each. So just make an ounce and have a 4 ounce pour. So we'll have that. We'll have paper planes. And we'll talk about their characters' relationship with each other.
Okay.
And we'll talk a little bit about ego and pride and the need for therapy and to listen to your therapist. and growth and, you know, maturity.
I feel like you're tiptoeing. Do you think Andrew broke up with Molly, yes or no?
Okay, so this goes into, like, my partner and I, like, ultimately we were very disappointed in the season finale just because
there's
so much open.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, I do think that Andrew broke up with Molly.
Okay.
Or he may be willing to give her a chance, but Molly's got to go back to her therapist and work out some things on her own.
Okay.
I think we've all had some Mollies in our life.
Mm-hmm.
We've all been, we might have been Molly at one point in our life.
Yes, yes.
But you've got to grow and change and you know, get better. So I haven't canceled Molly, but
I, I know some people have canceled Molly. It is a very interesting, I don't know. It's just like, oh, it makes the next season, I am ready for the next season to hurry up and get here. Last question regarding Insecure. Will Issa choose Nathan or Lawrence?
I think they wrapped up Nathan in the first 2 minutes. So like, it's great. I don't think she'll go back to him.
Okay.
Will she stick it out with Lawrence is the question. And I think ultimately she will.
Okay.
Right now, there's a lot of bruised egos at play. Mm. But I think that she
will get through that
and will continue to try and work past it.
Okay. All right. Well, who knew this would turn into an Insecure podcast, but here we are, Samara Rivers, Eddie Masonette, winding down on the season finale.
Whiskeying down.
See, branding. Yes. Whiskeying down on the Insecure season finale. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for sticking it out with us. Samara, you're excellent as always. Greatly appreciated. Thank you for being a thoughtful observer and supporter of what I've been doing, because it feels kind of like a ship in the night just trying to find your way. Hopefully you don't bump into a rock or into another ship or anything. And so definitely appreciate, it's good to find other people in the space who are not only welcoming, but willing to help people go in the right direction. So I tell you sincerely, thank you.
Thank you for having me. And yeah, I mean, it's a dark, lonely road at times. Mm-hmm. So, and I've been down it. I still am going down it. It's not clear for me either, but just keep pushing along inch by inch. Just keep doing what you're doing.
There it is. Samara Rivers, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Sit Mightily podcast. Find us on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll see you next time. Take it easy.